give you an update on CBI. Let's pick my topic, unfortunately, my title. Unfortunately, we do have these. And I talk mostly about polarization. We have the best detection of EE that's currently out there. Okay, so it's a telescope, and as skilled as a telescope goes, there's a tremendous amount of work involved in many people. It's run out of Caltech with huge inputs from CETA, analysis and computation, and from NRAO. Okay, so just a quick little bit about the instrument. It's an interferometer, which is a sort of radio telescope that combines electric fields in different areas. It's located high in the Andes at 5,000 meters in northern Chile. And it's pretty sensitive. We go there to get rid of, to get away from water vapor. 13 elements. I don't want to get too many details. Okay. It has been an experience, sort of a view from the trenches of how to actually go out and measure these things. It's at 5,000 meters. Your body doesn't work too well up there. It likes more oxygen than that. Our PI, that's Steve Bain, our project scientist, got into a disagreement about having vertical change degrees and radians when they were at altitude without oxygen. The area is used by NASA to check for if their equipment for finding life on Mars works or not, because that's the closest they can come up with. And, you know, I don't believe the moon landings were fake, but having been down to Chile, they could take Mars pretty easily, let's just say. We can't go off the road too much because there are landmines. It's quite an experience. So the rain in Spain may stay mainly in the plain, but the snow in Chile goes right to the highway, which makes getting up and down to the telescope interesting. One other feature to point out, these signs right there that look very faded, they actually are faded. They're almost new, but we had a windstorm that lasted for 36 hours with the staying wind speeds about 150 kilometers an hour, sandblasted all the paint off the road signs. There are other hazards too. This is a view from a telescope of a volcano nearby. It's actually very useful because it always gets in a telescope. It's our weather station. You can just look at the volcano smoke and see what the weather's going to be like. Okay. So a little bit about interferometers. As I said, they correlate the electric field coming in from antennas directly, which is nice because if you have only one signal, one problem in one antenna, it doesn't get picked up by the data. And so they're very resistant to systematics. One other nice feature about them is they directly measure the Fourier transform of the sky modulo the resolution set by the size of the field of view. But it doesn't pick up signals from long wavelengths. So for instance, if you've got an instrumental systematic, it doesn't pick up any power, if the system doesn't pick any power from the original monopole. Also, polarization, it directly measures EEG. And again, because it's directly measuring polarization and not trying to measure two differences in linear polarization from a total power experiment, if you've got a problem in one of those, you see a fake polarization signal for a total power, but for interferometers, because it never picks those up. It's a very clean way of measuring polarization. Okay, so here is the state of affairs in TT, since Flip said this is precision cosmology, so this is where the precision is. And I think most of you have probably seen at least most of this plot before. One interesting point to note, which I won't go into in great detail, is that actually people are seeing higher power loads than expected on the small angular scales. We think that's a signal of clusters of galaxies, but it's really an open question still.
So also the unbidden data? Can you pick it up from the unbidden data or just in the mean data loops?
Well, you really do need to at least get a power spectrum. And you can make a generic shape if you want to, which is as close as you can get data. You really do need to get the maximum sensitivity because it's a very faint signal. Okay, so I'm going to talk most about polarization, EE polarization in particular. And, you know, why do we, you know, the standard view is that it's directly from TT, which is perhaps true, but it's something that we need to check. And it's sort of a little toy model here. This, we say we have some very baroque PFK. The solid line is the best fit to WMAP, CBI, and TT, and it's better than that. The dashed line is what you get from some crazy set of cosmological parameters with this PFK. As you can see, if you only have TT, they're almost indistinguishable. But the degeneracy is broken. It's also good for things like isocurvature and construction of the final vision state? And does the whole picture hang together? Are we really right? Okay, so this is the state of affairs as of September last year at Cosmo 4, where both the CDI and CatMap results were released, and data had just come out a week before. This is just DE, and as you can see, you can start to see the bumps in the E spectrum. I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail. And so, as Lev said, we have some new results. We've increased the data by about 40%, and this is the state of affairs as of last week for this CDI. And things to note here are the significance of the E detection has gone up, and the error bars are somewhat smaller. It's a little hard to see by eye. I think they're about 20% smaller. And also, generic inflation predicts a very low B signal observed. And indeed, everything you see is consistent with zero, and that's good because that means we're not seeing a lot of foregrass signal. Okay, so as a check on whether the prediction from TT is lining up with EE, the first thing we do is take the shape that you predict from TT and measure an amplitude with that shape fixed in the power spectrum to the data. And when you do that, we find that the amplitude, these red lines are 68%, we find that the amplitude of the EE lines up very well. You know, it's within a sigma of what you'd expect. And the significance of this detection relative to zero is about 10.7 sigma now. And we also see TE at about 4 sigma. And BB, again, the power level is consistent with zero. It's 1.9, we see 1.9 plus or minus 2.2 microkelvin squared. And I'd like to just compare that to the signal here, which is up around 20 microkelvin, 30 microkelvin. So if there are big foregrounds, you start to skip. So things are looking pretty clean. Just really quickly flash through some parameters. Again, these are precision cosmology. So blue is WMAP, red is lithopolarization only added to WMAP, and then green is with our old TT stuff added. And you can see that the green helps break the genesis. The red is not too powerful yet. It will eventually become so.
So this is vector to this towards left. I'm sorry, less than one. So is you just fix it or you just
sorry,
the vector to the tennis.
Oh, no, that's fit.
That's fit, yeah.
I mean, it's still consistent with one. Sort of, it's about one sigma down from one or so, right?
So, the more, it definitely helps.
Yeah. So, it's not. And one particular parameter I want to note here is this theta. This is the distance, the angle diameter distance that assists the last scattering. People usually think about the first off the peak telling you the position of the value of omega. It really tells you the angle diameter distance, which happens to be almost a generic omega. But this is, that's the fundamental parameter that's really measured by the data. A few more parameters. Just how the A sharpens up and the sigma A sharpens up.
What's the reason behind why you see these are shifted?
We have more data. Everything is consistent.
It's basically because you have a longer base point of L in multiple space. That's the critical thing that adds.
For granted,
that's why we get annoyed when everybody puts up, this is a WMAP result because it's actually WMAP plus all of the hard work that's been done on the high L part of the spectrum.
Where the signal is much cleaner. And
which not that we're thinking anything away from WMAP, but it's.
I know, but this time, what I understand is that.
Right. In particular, a very good point is that OKM has no variable forecast, but with WMAP alone, you don't do very well with the dark matter, and you need the higher peaks.
Okay, so what can we do? We can't, the polarization data is not in a state where you can just throw the polarization by itself into an MCMC chain and get tight limits on parameters up. But if you restrict yourself to certain more narrow questions, where you don't open parameter space quite that much, you can actually start to get fairly significant results just from VD alone and say, is everything lining up? Because again, that's a quite important thing to do. So, one of the tests we've done, we've got those two, so I won't go into this at the time, is say EE had, picked out a different scale on the sky, a different value of theta, not physics ideas. It's a little odd physically, but I guess the first line of something like the angular diameter, the surface glass scattering, was coming from a different place of polarization. So if we, in the power spectrum, this black model is a generic TT prediction, and then red is if I just shift that theta parameter by a little bit. So you can see here, in the shape is off pretty far here. There is a slight degeneracy, especially if you don't have low L beta, if I slide one peak onto the next peak. And this this shows up in CDI data. So here is CDI alone, and you can see that it's relatively narrowly peaked around zero, but here is that degeneracy I was talking about. And this is the TT prediction. So this is just CBI data alone. Daisy is CBI's sister experiment, and they have a knee detection at lower L, which breaks this degeneracy. So if you take CBI and Daisy data together, you actually get a nice result. So the other peak is over here. Red is CBI, gray is Daisy. And so Daisy does not have peaks over here, and CBI is that one over there. But this Daisy one kills that off, and then the CBI one kills it pretty sharp. And so blue is just from polarization alone, and it's about a 3 or 4% error on the on the distance of the surface of glass scatter. And then the green dagger is what you get from TT, which is much better. This is probably this is the best determined quantity in cosmology. It's about 0.5% better than 0.5%. So, but at this point now, at 3 or 4%. If there was something even somewhat fishy about the situation, you'd start to pick up. Okay. Now, we've also, this is as of last night, done some non-gassy entity tests. So far what we've done is to do the to decompose the data into signal-to-noise eigenmodes, and then check the one-point distribution of those independent modes. You can see here, this top plot is a histogram. For you picked out the modes that are got the highest signal, and the top plot is a histogram for TT, and the bottom plot is a histogram for EE. I don't know if you can see the red lines. Okay. So that's the Gaussian distribution, and things are really quite consistent. So there are 5,500 nodes in TT and 3,800 in EE. Okay. And I see that I think the first time, actually pretty much the first time anybody's checked Gaussian for EE. So the results. It's not incredible precision yet, but things are coming along, and everything so far is consistent. And if there were a huge foreground signal again, one might have started to show up. Okay, and just to look for some L-dependent effects, we've done to measure the kurtosis for the error bars in each of our 7 bins. Things are again consistent with the Gaussian entity. And this red point at the end is what you get if you combine all the modes from polarization together. So far, everything remains Gaussian. Okay, so just in summary, precision this year in TT, and it's coming along in EE. It's wouldn't call it precision cosmology from EE yet, but it's getting better, and things will be coming down the road in the future. Will be quite good. The detection now at 10.7 sigma. Our detection is very clean, which is nice. The interferometers, there are a lot of system effects that you don't have to deal with. And everything is consistent between polarization and total intensity. We can measure restricted questions, some of them to 3 or 4% now in polarization only, and everything so far is Gaussian.
So what happens to the DB modes? Did you put in constraint on the depth?
So the DB power goes negative, and if you have a negative power, it sort of screws up a simple one-point distribution. Mm-hmm. And as I said, this is the last one. I didn't have a chance to straighten that out.
I'm not sure that was the question, if you could say again. I think the question was much more, are you constrained to be to zero? The answer is no. It's actually found to be consistent with zero, which is what you expect from the regime. This is begging the issue of the ultimate measurability on large scales of the DB mode, which would be the slow gun, presumably, everything but Yuan's modeling, which he's got unfortunately too low an energy level of inflation. And of course, we all have our fingers crossed that he's completely wrong, because the holy grail of microwave background is to go for B, D, and C, primary gravity.
One more questions?
Sure, we got to see that it's about present day, because all the other points are still there.
Okay, so I want to talk about double problem basket structure, and again, I did not use the title. So, one of the shortest videos on double problem basket structure. This will be following Jonathan a bit about precision cosmology, but as we see, the W is really a very tough parameter, and so we are not very precise yet. So, what I'm going to basically talk in the next 10 minutes is I'll tell you what are the different probes that people are thinking about when they are trying to go to W, where we stand at present, and what kind of precision we are thinking or we are aiming at. Okay. So let's start with the list of the probes. When I talk about black hole structure, the first probe is after supernova, which everyone has heard about, and I'm not going to talk about supernova at all. The next one is something called, which is the galaxy cluster, or rather the evolution of galaxy clusters. So we can sort of measure the evolution of galaxy clustering or galaxy clustering, and then constrain something from that. Then there is the shape and amplitude of the power spectrum of galaxies, Lyman alpha forest, cluster of galaxies. All of these can give constraints of W. There is something called the variant oscillations in the galaxy power spectrum, which actually is quite powerful, and potentially quite powerful as a probe of W. Then there is the weak lensing power spectrum, weak lensing tomography, which is also pretty powerful, so all power fields are in red. Then the redshift distribution of galaxy clusters are quite biased towards this, and this is also very powerful as a probe of W. Then you can cross-correlate the ICE W with basket structure, and that can also be used to constrain W, but it's not very powerful. And there are others which have been talked about, like redshift distribution of galaxies, the Kato redshift distribution function, loopback time to galaxy clusters, and other distances. So there's a list of probes that people are using, or thinking of using to probe W. But what actually happens is that these are just the probes. The basic thing is in the underlying probes. What underlying probes is that if you look at so there are the figures where I have put 10% measurement errors on any one of these things. So this is the expansion, this phi h of z. This is the distance which the supernova looks at. This is the growth factor, so how the perturbations, how the density grows in the universe. R squared, h of z, this is sort of the volume, and this is sort of the dt/dz, which is the rate of change of growth with redshift. And over here is the omega w constraint, if we have sort of fixed only, if all the other parameters are fixed, all the other cosmological parameters, then we sort of say that we are getting these parameters to 10% accuracy. And over here is w0 and wk is the first derivative of w. And as you can see, the dg, which is the rate of change of growth factor, is the most powerful. But unfortunately, the probe that uses this is cross-correlation of the ISW with large structures. That has noise, a lot of noise, so it's not very powerful. If you look at the R of it, that is a supernova. If you look at the volume, if you combine the volume and the growth factor, then you get the redshift distribution of clusters or redshift distribution of galaxies. So we can use all of these and to constrain them. Now, one thing it's very easily can see over here is that as soon as we put, so over here this W was a single W, so there was no evolution of W, no redshift evolution of W. So we get this error. But as soon as we have a redshift evolution of W, the error was. So that's one thing to take over here. The other thing is that over here, these different intrinsic probes have different degeneracies. So if you can combine them, so if you can combine supernova, which is like this, with clusters, which will be like this, then you're going to get those degeneracies. You're going to get better clusters.
So you mentioned that, but what is W to A? I'm sorry.
So you have parameterized W as W naught, plus R.
The first derivative, okay, sir. And it's very consistent with zero, actually.
Yeah, this is not from data.
Oh,
okay. This is not from data. So we don't have the data. This is about CDI. So this is, we're taking a fiducial model of, which is basically, yeah, that's
so
minus one. And saying that we can determine the determination sense. So these are the underlying proofs, but this is not actually the proofs. The proofs will be slightly different, and the error must be slightly different. Okay. So a little bit of everything. First is, galaxy redshift distribution. Now, these days, simulations basically tell us quite accurately the number of galaxies or small halos that we'll expect in a larger halo. And if we use that, then we can test better. The second is the galaxy power spectrum. This is actually a measurement from SDSS. You see the different university galaxies, and you see the different power spectrums. And one can compare this galaxy power spectrum with the theoretical power spectrum, and then you can see that.
So I'm going to just go back. You will not be able to see all small halos.
So you will have to associate the small halo that is still galaxies over some mass. So basically, you are saying that, okay, let's say we take these galaxies, which are like Kepler 12 to certain galaxies. Problem is there, of course, we will not be detecting the masses, we will detect the luminosity. So there has to be a mass and luminosity probability, which is also the same over here, same problem over here. Another problem over here is that, as you can see, depending on the different luminosities, the different galaxy power spectrums are different bias to the underlying matter power spectrum. So again, you have to know what's the luminosity bias. So people have looked at this, and the kind of error and value from this is not precise, I would say, compared to the other errors. Then the thing which is slightly more interesting, probably more powerful, is baryonic oscillations. So what we have done over here is basically, this is a plot of pk versus pk0, and pk0 is where the omega variance is 0. And we basically showed you that there are these peaks, which are the baryonic oscillations in the power spectrum of galaxies. And if you have like 500 to the 5 galaxies, like 500,000 galaxies, then you can actually go and sort of use the baryonic oscillations as a probe. Now, I'll come to this in a minute.
And you can look at the degeneracy for all three, or just omega h and omega d, and because you listed the two values of these three quantities.
Yeah, this is basically because in the power spectrum, these are the things that are coming. But when you are doing it, will be the whole concept will come, so it's a picture. And of course, there is this weak lensing, and you can get the weak lensing, so we can get the shear power spectrum, we can get the galaxy shear power spectrum. So there are different cross power spectrum, all the auto power spectrum of weak lensing. And then you can see that over there also, these are the powers. And so this is another thing. If you can get this part, these are kind of error bars. So this is a sort of a lensing survey where you get 100 galaxies, background galaxies for half minutes square. And we cover like 1%, so 1%, sorry, for like 10% of the sky. So this is like a lensing survey on the, it's not from ground, so it's from space. And with RMS noise of around 40%. Depends on galaxies. You can see that you can actually construct the shear power spectrum. So what has happened is that the whole galaxies are divided into two groups, two redshift ranges. So this is the auto correlation of the lower redshift range, this is auto correlation of the upper redshift range, and this is the cross correlation. And you can, the kind of error bar that you see, that actually at large values, you can actually determine this power spectrum. So you can use this to get your W. The reason you use all these things to get your W is that all of these basically tells you somehow how your expansion is H of Z, not a growth function. All of the volume elements in these galaxies, they are evolving. And those are very strong functions of W. So one can use those things to get W. And as I said, the lensing is pretty powerful, and if you can sort of see over here, there's this block over here. So if you look at this plot, so you can see if you use the lensing power spectrum as well as the lensing light spectrum from all the surface, which is like 10% of the sky, the one that I showed you before, you can get around approximately 10% on W naught and 30% on W of A. So it is not that decisive. So approximately around 10% on W naught and 30% on W A that we're getting, compared to other performance with parameters, which are like 3%. Okay, so let's focus on one more, which is the cluster of galaxies. And with cluster of galaxies, the thing that we do is that we look at the redshift distribution of the cluster of galaxies. And over here, I've plotted the W dependence of the redshift distribution of the cluster of galaxies. And on the right-hand side, I've plotted the Omega matter dependence. So this is what we're going to probe. As you can see, I've changed the W, so there are three W's over here. The red, the green, and the solid line, these are for W of minus 1. So this is minus 1, this is minus 0.6, and this is minus 0.2. The thing which sees that the shape of the TNDZ actually differs. So there is a possible over here. And this is because the group function for the different W is changing, and also the following element is changing. So actually, if we can differentiate this TNDZ from the observation, then we can actually use this to constrain W. One thing I'd like to note over here is that if you look at the omega matter dependence and look at the three green curves over here, these are for three different omega matter in our flat universe. Now what is happening over here is that as you change the omega matter, there are no crossing of the curves. So what's happening is that as you change the omega matter, only the amplitude of the curves are changing. Whereas over here, if you change W, the shape of the curves are changing. So this is potentially quite powerful, because not only the amplitude, but also the shape of the function. And the reason is we are going from a volume sample to a region of redshift where the growth function is taking over. So there's a competition between your volume and the growth function in terms of learning. Now, DNGZ of W is potentially very powerful. And the reason is that there are a lot of surveys which are already being planned in South Pole. They're already planned, like SZ surveys, or there was some XS surveys which were being planned, also frequency. And they're going to detect lots of clusters, like about 10,000 clusters. And if you look over here, you'll see that, so this one is the South Pole, the project one. This one is the South Pole telescope. And the thing to see is that the others are X-ray or frequency. And actually, with the SZ surveys, you can go very far, very high in redshift. So we can actually, if there is a W which depends on redshift, if there is a redshift dependent W, then these clusters, when taking these clusters, you can prove the redshift dependence of W. So let's look at some forecasts over here. These are what kind of, so if you look at this one at the top, these are forecasts for the South Pole telescope. And this one, the smallest one, line over here, the solid black line, is what you would expect on a constant equation state from 20,000 clusters from the South Pole telescope. If we fold in the information from the redshift dependence of clusters and also the prospects of these clusters. Now, if we compare this with what we have at present, so this is the best W constraint that we have at present. This is from SDSS data. And the innermost control is from the WMAP plus the galaxy power spectrum, the bias, the Lyman-Alkin power spectrum for SDSS. And if you compare the error bar, the present error bar, with the one that we focused on here, you can see there's quite a bit of improvement. You can do the same thing with our changing W, the W and W prime. And over here, there is this WA and W0, this is W0 over here. The three curves over here is the one, the outermost curve is when you have from CMB alone. The one in the middle is when you have from the cluster, the South Pole telescope. And when you combine both the CMB and the clusters, you see that you get a very tight constraint on W. In comparison to that, the present constraints on W0 and WL like this, which is pretty big. So if you look at the present constraints on W0 and W, it's like 20% on W0 and 80% on W. The best constraints are present if you have a time very simple evolution on W. In comparison, we expect 3 to 4 times better improvement with the clusters analysis. So in conclusion, what we expect? We expect that we look at the most promising of the surveys, which is the South Pole Telescope for cluster of galaxies, and the follow-up of optical follow-up, which will also do 4,000 square degrees. And the time scale is around 2007, where the South Pole Telescope starts working, 2009, where the optical follow-up starts working, and it will go to 2014. And from here, we can add all the information, like the cluster, SZ, DNDZ, the redshift distribution, the cluster cross spectrum, the galaxy cross spectrum from this optical, the galaxy cross spectrum Riggles, the weak lensing, and the spunover. All this will be available from the South Pole and GDS. If we add all of these, then what we can see that each of them can sort of determine W to 5% and W to 50%. And if we can add all of these, we can actually try to do like a decision that thing that Jonathan was saying, like 1 to 2% of W0. Now, an important thing to remember over here is that, of course, we have to control the systematics and cosmology, gastronomy, gas physics, regionalysis, what it is. So, at present, we have around 20% position on W0 and 80% on WOK. In 10 years of time, when you have all this data, and these things are only conditions, so these surveys are going to happen. We will probably get combined all the information that we have, all the last test structure reports, around 1 to 2% on W0 and around 10% on W0.
It's about order of magnitude improvement there, then yes.
Yes, if you have it.
The last segment is the introductory of the Elton Valley. The universe physics sense.
I'm going to discuss molecular dynamics of matter fields during the stage realized soon after the end of inflation stage. So why this stage is important for cosmology? First of all, it defines initial conditions for the hot universe stage, heating temperature, for example, and the matter content. Then it defines the relation between the number of inflationary deformings and physical wavelengths of perturbations which we currently observe. So here is the formula. Here is the corresponding wave number, and then the number of deformings, while delta is the parameter which is defined by physics after inflation. In our paper, we calculate this delta. It turned out to be 0.03, which is not that small, because this number is quite precisely known right now. There are also some other reasons, such as modulated fluctuations and cosmological particle release, which are not going to discuss. It could be very interesting for field and string theories as well, because the adequate language for describing dynamics of field during this stage is non equilibrium quantum field theory. And actually, the main features of field dynamics are related with non perturbative effects in non equilibrium quantum field theory. So, this is a kind of standard model for preheating and thermalization. It contains, its matter sector contains in photon field and matter field. So inflation in this model is just usual chaotic inflation when the quark density seeds give info about field and which starts its motion at some value larger than Planck and then slowly rolls down to towards the minimum of its potential. When it reaches value of order and Planckian over 2, inflation comes to the end and inflaton starts to oscillate near the minimum of its potential energy. As well, thus the effective frequency for the matter field. When you have some typical feature of parametric resonance and huge, very quick creation of particles of chi and decay of inflaton field, condensate of inflaton. But we are mostly interested not in reheating, but the stages which are going up. So, fortunately, since the number of particles which are created during reheating is astronomically huge, actual dynamics is quite a classical one, and we can use lattice simulations to understand what happens further after the end of reheating. So, if you follow the dynamics of total number density of fields, you can easily see that it could be divided into 3 stages. First stage continues during approximately 100 oscillations of inflaton field, 10 to the minus 35 seconds. As you see, this is reheating, and there is a huge creation of particles of both fields, inflaton field. On the language of non-equilibrium quantum field theory, you are dealing with linear non-equilibrium equilibrium. Next stage is also very short, about 100 oscillations. This one. Since occupation numbers are parametrically large, many particle diagrams contribute largely in the dynamics of field, and actually you are dealing with nonlinear, non-perturbative equilibrium. Theoretically, we don't keep this stage under control. So next stage is when numbers of particles slightly drop down and you have nonlinear perturbative fusion, which is described by usual Boltzmann kinetic equation. This stage is also very often discussed, and that's actually when true thermalization of system happens. Here you can see the spectra of numbers of particles of chi, and these are the energy densities at various moments of time as a function of characteristic momentum. So again, it's relatively easy to divide the dynamics into 3 stages. So red curves here corresponds to the heating stage, and as you see, the spectrum in the end of the heating stage is very far from thermal. So this orange curve corresponds to nonlinear non-perturbative stage of kinetics, and finally this slowly relaxing curve corresponds to perturbative nonlinear region. The same is here. The peak which you see here and this curve corresponds to the reheating stage. Then this peak slowly relaxing to the equilibrium value. And finally you get the slow relaxation. This is nonlinear perturbative region.
When you say reheating, do you mean by equilibrium distribution? The way I would expect reheating to be nonlinear. Should have thermal equilibrium as
there is no thermal equilibrium in the end of the heating stage. This is a big mistake to discuss things like reheating temperature immediately after the end of the heating stage before thermalization actually can happen. Reheating is a very quick stage, while thermalization is a macroscopically long stage. So actually that's why reheat temperature rather than constant to deal with this.
No, because this can only give you kinetic equilibrium at best. It will never give you chemical equilibrium. Yeah, because chemical equilibrium requires number changing processes. Which
but you know, you need to find at least this one at best. So typically, what you have is quite non-thermal spectrum. So actually, you don't have any thermal distribution. You don't have any reheat temperature.
But these calculations, of which it's these last calculations, presumably, are all based upon that specific Lagrangian inversion down, and you might expect that there would be more couplings that would perhaps accelerate.
You know, it's quite a universal model. It turns out it's quite a universal model. If you ask,
well, no, but then there's five subcouplings and lots of crosstalk which could occur on modes.
So basically,
wouldn't have included, right?
So there are simulations with tens of other models.
Right.
Yes, and the rule is very generic. If you have one field which is out of equilibrium, what it does, it drags all other fields out of equilibrium. And the whole system goes towards symbolization by its own. It takes a long time. The bottom line is you have all the fields which are in all fields which are in the spectrum in theory first out of equilibrium. Even if only one component.
Oh, no, I don't deny that at all. It's just a great approach to what is in effect a thermal distribution.
It
will depend upon how psi couples to itself and then propagates into that phi square.
There is no such thing as thermal distribution of the
Would this play against
sure.
the
It is going to sure. There's no question.
But it's much slower. It happens much later.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but there is an interesting question, which is completely related to the self-coupling of time.
Yeah, and you never see it in the logic simulations because the simulation is purely, it's a quantum, basically quantum process in logic simulations.
Basically, what you want to find at the end of the day is Bose-Einstein distribution with characteristic particle occupation numbers of order of one. So, this relaxation of this distribution in the Bose-Einstein will take microscopic and watch that.
But when I'm writing the next comment, you have made a very strong comment. So would this really go against the Pellitian?
No.
Because your comment on that, I mean, if you have a set, any single field which goes non-equilibrium, it drives other fields also towards non-equilibrium. Now, but then at the end of the day, we do see, thermal physics.
How do you observe? Do you
observe? Plenty of time.
I would be, so basically it takes a long time for the K-modes.
And another thing, the characteristic temperature is very, very long in this case, because it takes a lot of time, characteristic temperature will be very, very long. So the emissions give you numbers for the 0.1 electron volt.
But that is a calculation of a calculatable transport thing.
Very rather simple. It's very difficult to do. It's a big subject in non-equilibrium physics.
Yeah.
It's a big subject.
Rick physics, actually. You don't know how to Rick physics. Rick physics.
We keep in touch.
So anyway, let me continue. Well, as I said, thermalization takes a very, very long time. So it's either we are doing something wrong or something wrong with our model, because characteristic temperature will be in there of the back is too low over 40 minutes of heaven. But I would like you to notice the following thing. If you take strongly infrared modes on this floor, and this is energy density, as you can see here. These are quite close to thermal equilibrium. Exactly to thermal equilibrium on this floor would correspond to what we use. And actually, I would say for any modes which are which have k less than m q requires thermal equilibrium between quickly after the end of the stage, actually immediately after the end of the stage. And let me show another picture. These are effective equations of state which drives the expansion of your universe. And surprisingly, you see that this integral thing thermalized pretty quickly, actually immediately after the end of the heating stages. Very nice thing, because if you take a look on distribution, or on particle distribution function, it is very far from thermal equilibrium, while integral quantities, like fractional state, actually thermalized pretty quickly. So this is a signal for us. And actually, we propose to change the paradigm.
What I'm saying is that infrared MOS, thermalized HPP, I'm slightly lying to you because it means that K should be less than M, which is 10 to the 12 GB, which is more than enough for any standard model things or entirely continuous things. And we don't speak about real temperature after reheating, but about effective temperature. So effective temperatures in this scenario actually are also very high, on the level of 10 to the 14, 10 to 15. And this is also rather typical universal thing. So this is the answer to your
question. Why do I care about this temperature? Because it's not
because you need thermal state.
But it's not the temperature of my thermal, thermal band.
Why?
But
it's thermal what?
What is the scale of your physics? Because it seems that the scale much less than...
No, but at the end of the day, I do care about my thermal physics.
No, why? 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 Why?
What for? So you want to solve
the problem this more.
No,
this
is
a huge scale. Okay.
Tell the physical problem.
Give me that. Big bang doesn't. I do care about that.
It's much later.
But
it's much later. By this time, you already thermalized. But the question is, what was the highest possible
That can be as good as your input on mass temperatures, but I wouldn't care.
This is very bad.
No, the thing is that, yeah, it's bad, but what I'm suggesting is that at the end of the day, we'll have entropy dumping.
You have entropy dumping all the time.
We yes.
already have all the
general reheating.
So that's the solution. But then all the relevant quantities like gravity or abundance or baryon asymmetry, all these things will be diluted accordingly.
No.
So at the end of the day,
what should I do? No, I will not be diluted because you already have radiation dependent equation of state. You have the same entropy. Entropy is gradient. It's not changing anymore. You just redistribute things in the amount more.
Right.
So there is obsession with so-called ultimate reheat temperature.
Sure. But okay. I mean, this is a part of the assumption. We haven't checked that the entropy is behaving like exactly adiabatically.
It is adiabatic.
I do have mentioned that.
It is adiabatic. It's not a thing,
it's just a thing. Dynamics is pretty slow, and slow relaxation.
But what Nalokam is saying, if you produce more photons, then the number of the reheat will be diluted. But you're not producing. Look at the number of particles over there. It stays.
It stays
constant.
Well, you're in photons, you don't move decays, but it's not the heat costs, but the heating costs.
Okay, so my only question was the final reheating process will generate enough entropy.
No.
Not enough, okay, some entropy, so that at the end of the day, what
should I care about? Factor, I don't care about factor. You start to produce gravitinos immediately.
Okay, I mean, let's not go into gravitinos because it depends very much.
You start to produce everything.
No, sure, you produce everything, but the concern is that why do I care about the heat temperature because that's the thermal. Yeah, whatever you're transmitting a non-thermal.
No, it is also thermal. Those modes are already thermal. Those are relevant modes.
How can you say thermal? Because there's no number changing processes going on. I can see kinetic equilibrium very well, because you can redistribute the momentum.
Equation of state. This is what other people call it pre-thermalization.
Equation of state.
You have all the features
thermalized.
You have
transport to equilibrium value immediately after the end of the heating. As well in front of more. So that's it.
Well, there is an issue. So what we have is the amount of energy is in lower K modes. And then there's the K mode cascade, which is going to higher and higher. That does create an entropy.
What is the number of this so-called low K? Low K is 10 to 6.
No, I know that. Therefore, it is a, well, I don't know exactly how we're characterizing. I mean, there is a distribution function which exists for these modes.
Yes,
and then that maps into ultimately a thermal distribution. And the question is whether or not in that transition there is a change of the entropy which is not connected to the abundance of gravitinos that are created by the huge amount of concentrated energy here. And quantitatively, I don't have a good handle on the level at which this occurs. Neat question, but I don't know what the answer is.
It's a very difficult problem in quantum field theory, symbolization. It's a very difficult problem. The big reviews is no result so far.
So the message is use non-equilibrium quantum field theory. But
at the end you do require a term of this.
And then the day problem.
So is it gentle surface?
I'm
going to what exactly is
happening. It's a distribution as well. So it's relaxing, and this relaxation is extremely small, that's what I see.
So there is no generation of energy.
There is
no. Anyway, we are ready to close. Thanks for organizers. So,
So thanks to all the speakers and all the participants, and to those strong and patient enough to stay here at the end of the day, we have refreshed.